Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, a focus on the Middle East with Christians on the front lines in Iraq and lighting smiles on little faces, how a Catholic home for disabled children is bringing age-old enemies together in the Holy Land. If there's one common denominator of Christian churches, it has to be hope. But in at least one of the countries of the world, that hope is fast running out, if it's not gone already. Since the overthrow of Saddam Hussein in 2003 and the countrywide violence that ensued, Iraq's dwindling Christian community has been targeted by extremists and crooks who've used kidnapping and extortion, killings and bombings to finance their arsenals and rid the predominantly Muslim nation of the small Christian presence. Christians have fled the violence in droves, and even more want to leave, following a deadly series of attacks on seven Baghdad churches in July that left dozens dead or injured. Some 750,000 Christians have fled the country over the last decade, decimating the number of Christians in Iraq. Chris Altieri tells us more.
Lack of economic opportunity and inadequate services have encouraged many Christians to leave, while others have abandoned their ancient homeland because of ongoing violence. Chaldean Archbishop Louis Sacco of Kirkuk in northern Iraq told us that despite their best efforts, government and the police have yet to bring the Christian security situation under control. The Archbishop went on to say that Christians are generally being attacked not because they are Christian, but because they are seen to be defenseless.
We are for the coexistence between all the groups, and also for the culture of peace and also dialogue.
As government agencies seek to improve, Archbishop Sacco is seizing the moment as one for civil society and religious leaders of every confession to come together in search of concrete ways to serve the common good and build a future for their country.
So we have to forgive each other and to start a new life and with new relations with each other.
Archbishop Sacco is calling on Western countries to pressure Iraqi political groups to reconcile and to try to reduce conflict and restore law and order. Fewer than 400,000 Christians remain in Iraq, where the church has been present since the first century and traces its origins to St. Thomas the Apostle. I'm Chris Altieri.
Aid to the Church in Needs, John Pontifex, told Irene Lagan that Iraqi Christians are demoralized and see little hope for a better future.
The problem for the church in Iraq is that it really does now face the final showdown as to whether it will survive in the long term. It, for many, many years now, in the years since the fall of Saddam, what we've seen is the church beginning to decline. There have been attacks against it. But for a long period of time, the church remained very robust. Now it seems that the opportunities they were looking for in order to strengthen their position and bolster their hopes for the future have all disappeared. And so the situation is one of marked lack of confidence.
Now, the attacks against Christians, are they increased in number, worsening in severity, a combination of the two? And is it a combination of just lawlessness? Why are Christians being so targeted?
The main reason is not because of their religion. We're not seeing people being attacked because of the faith they profess. They're being attacked because They do not have a militia. They do not have access to a militia of any description. And this means that they are easy targets. And what underlies that is a sense in which Christians are seen to be nobody in society, that nobody will spring to their defense. So they're just easy targets for attacks. Really, looting, means of extortion, obtaining money through abduction, kidnapping, and really bully boys simply wanting to throw their weight around and show who's boss in a local neighborhood.
And this is not new news, what's happening to Christians. Have there been no measures taken for law and order or to help the plight of Christians? Surely their Muslim neighbors are aware of their plight, yes?
They most certainly are, and Archbishop Lewis Sacco from Kirkuk, who has spoken most fluently on this subject for many years now, has been at the forefront of efforts to mobilize the Muslim community to work alongside their Christian brothers and sisters, recognizing, of course, that in former years the two communities did work alongside one another quite adequately. But the main reason why the Muslim community doesn't seem to be able to prevent further attacks against the Christians is because of the breakdown of law and order. This is a point made clear by Archbishop Lewis Sacco again and again.
Is there anything that the parliament or the government is doing to rectify the situation?
Yes. It has a lot to do with the fact that the Western powers, the US, the UK, and other communities involved in the protection of Iraq have now begun their withdrawal under intense pressure to do so. And Archbishop Sacco himself has spoken out against this, not because he feels that it's an ideal situation to have Western foreign powers resident there, acting as a security system. It smacks to them in Iraq of colonialism, even if it isn't that. But the problem is that there's no security substitute. There isn't the power of any security system there to prevent law and order breakdown in the way that we have seen. And indeed, the power politics has broken down so far into factionalism, so that no one community power system has authority.
You said they're leaving in droves. Do you have any idea of what numbers we have left there? And what would a future look like without Christians in Iraq?
Well, no one really has been able to say for certain what the situation is, re-numbers in Iraq, because we're dealing in a situation of flux with people on the move, and where, of course, for security reasons, it's impossible really to do an adequate survey. But Archbishop Sacco, in this interview I had with him, gave up-to-date figures. This is a man who can be relied upon to give an accurate, or as near as damn it, an accurate approach to this matter. And he's now saying that there are less than 400,000 Christians in Iraq, which is about 750,000 down on 1999. And you have to recognize also that within that 400,000, you have a large group who are not in their home. They are living in displacement camps or living away from home in some shape or form. And also, B, a good number of those are desperate to leave. And I myself have been to Iraq about a year ago. And at that time, we found countless people who were desperate to get to the West, get away from Iraq at all costs. So the numbers are tragic, but they themselves don't actually point to the severity of the situation. Iraq used to have 1.4 million Christians in it in the last census that was taken in 1987. It's now down to 400,000. That's bleak enough. But the figures themselves don't show quite how serious the situation is. concerning the destabilization of the Christian community. We can see that their position politically has been very considerably weakened, and that their position legally, as we've discussed, that too has been undermined, and their position socially has also been under threat, because, as Bishop Sacco says, a good number of these Christians are struggling to get basic jobs, and these communities are often the better educated ones. Christians have made as they do in so many countries, they make a particular focus on education, and even though many of them are better qualified than their Muslim brothers and sisters, they're still struggling to get jobs. So that you've got all the indications of a crisis.
John Pontifex is head of press and information for the UK-based agency Aid to the Church in Need. It was some 2,000 years ago, in a small village nestled in the hills west of Jerusalem, that two women met, their bellies swollen with new life, filled with a new hope for all mankind.
Mary set out at that time and went as quickly as she could to a town in the hill country of Judah. She went into Zechariah's house and greeted Elizabeth.
In his Gospel, St. Luke tells us Mary hastened to the hill country of Judah, today the town of An Karim, to be with her cousin Elizabeth, who in her old age was with child.
Now, as soon as Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, the child leapt in her womb, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit. She gave a loud cry and said, "Of all women, you are the most blessed, and blessed is the fruit of your womb. Why should I be honored with a visit from the mother of my Lord? For the moment your greeting reached my ears, the child in my womb leapt for joy."
Not long after that encounter, Mary gave birth to the Lord Jesus in Bethlehem. Elizabeth gave birth to St. John in the village of An Karim. Today, churches recalling the birthplace and desert wanderings of St. John the Baptist, and a mosque dot the hillsides of An Karim, but no Arab Christians or Muslims live there. The land fell to the new state of Israel in the War of 1948. But the Christian witness of these two mothers to life, love, and sacrifice lives on today in a small community of Catholic sisters in An Karim who care for disabled Arab and Jewish children, bridging the bitterness and hatred of decades of conflict.
Muslim and Christian and Jewish children live together, their parents meet and deal with their problems. And then you have volunteers who are Jewish volunteers, foreign volunteers from Germany, from Holland, from Italy, from Russia. It's a place that really, although it represents the history of Jerusalem and all the troubles of Jerusalem in a way too, because a lot of wars were fought there too, it's today very peaceful, and it's a little piece of coexistence in a city where it is like under conflict all the time, and you enter and care and you feel the peace.
Freelance journalist Lamia Lahoud lives in the Holy Land. She says she felt that special peace when she visited the Daughters of Charity of St. Vincent de Paul's home for physically and mentally disabled children in An Karim. The sisters, with an international team of volunteers, care for 60 to 70 children from the Jerusalem area, but also from Arab Bedouin areas like Beit Sheba. The children come from Arab and Jewish families, and here in An Karim, they support and comfort each other in their grief.
And people who would normally never mix and not talk to each other, really. I mean, a Bedouin family from Beit Sheba living in the desert, and, you know, a Jewish family from Jerusalem, sometimes upper-class Jewish family, how would they meet? They would never have a chance to meet. Here, they both have the same tragedy in their family. They have children, and at least one of their children is terribly disabled. So They share their fears, their joys, their pains. They meet regularly. They have parent meetings. They all cooperate together. They organize things there. And they really work very, very closely together. And on that level, they actually are an example of how to make peace, because these people sit down together, they discuss their problems, they work together, and it's very heartwarming to see how these families get together and share their the tragedy that links them, kind of, their children, and how they deal with it, and on a human level.
And it's beautiful that one will support the other when parents of handicapped children get together and share their grief and their joys, and both communities, you know, both families help each other. And also our staff are mixed, both Arab and Jewish caregivers, professionals, and they work together also, which is beautiful. And we have volunteers from Europe. They're an important part of our program. They're 20 to 24 young people, college age usually, who after high school or after college come and give 6 months to a year of their time, full time, 6 days a week to a group of children. Each volunteer has 4 children that they get to know and they like parent them.
Sister Susan Sheehan is one of 5 sisters and dozens of volunteers who parent the children in Ankara. Their children are so severely handicapped that many cannot raise their heads, much less walk or even eat by themselves. Children who many people today would say have no reason to live or should die because they are a burden on society. But to Sister Susan and her team, these little lives are no burden. Her quandary is simply, can she do enough for them?
Handicapped children have such great needs that you can never meet all their needs. So you always feel like you should be able to do more.
But the sisters do more in the cases of children who end up in their home after being abandoned.
Usually they're abandoned in the hospital and they've never known their parents. And most of them come to us a year or two in the hospital, so they've raised in a very sterile situation and not been cuddled and hugged. And some of them will not want us to even touch them in the beginning when they first come to us. So it takes us 6 months to a year to get them to be affectionate and responsive to affection and love.
There was a little boy whose parents just couldn't handle the fact that he was handicapped nor could take him home.
So he came directly to us, but we found that mentally he was a little higher than some and he can repeat words. And the sisters taught him Abba and Ima, which is mother and father. And we started realizing that the parents were very sweet people. They just didn't have the courage to visit their son. So the social worker and the sisters worked with them until one day they came to the home, and the boy saw his father a long distance away, and he yelled right out, Abba, Abba, Abba. And the father melted. And I think so did we, of course. And ever since, they've taken the child out every single Saturday.
Though this child learned how to say Abba, Father, most of Sister Susan's children cannot speak a word.
There are some that, very few, but some that have no reaction, maybe 3 out of the 60, but almost all have a smile. And, of course, others, they tell us a lot through their eyes. We figure when you work with the handicapped here that our volunteers take about 1 month to be able to understand all their nonverbal communication. And it's really beautiful what happens between volunteers and children and what happens between parents and their children. Most of the parents visit those that are in the area. The parents from Beersheba, they have to come on several buses. They have big families. They come less frequently.
You walk out of there and you feel uplifted because you saw that there is love, that there is normal life and all the abnormality.
I think people really get attached to the children, and when we really see it when the staff buy the children clothing and toys. We really see it when any staff member or volunteer leaves the home, and it's just traumatic for them to leave their children. And for young people, I think it's a chance for them to parent before marriage, to realize what a commitment is, what a bonding takes place when one starts caring for a child, be it a normal child or a handicapped child. And it's traumatic for the children also when their main caregivers leave and we'll have children that won't eat for a few days. We will have others that can express themselves. We have three that can carry on a conversation. We have another three that can speak words. Then we have a few that just babble, and it's not necessarily appropriate what they're saying at the moment. But most of our children have some reaction.
Sister Susan sees how the children react to each other when they're placed side by side and can touch each other. Unlike language, touch offers no barriers to friendship or to love.
Almost all of our children are nonverbal communicators, so we often lay them together on a mattress, mat, so that they can touch each other and they can reach out to each other. And it's very important that they realize that they're in a room with other children. Sometimes their vision is poor, so they don't catch everything. Most of them, I think we only have one that's deaf, so they do hear, but they often feel isolated, always in their chair, in their bed by themselves. It's very important that they have a chance to physically communicate daily, several times daily. And those that are a little higher level, they babble to each other, and they're in wheelchairs together. They reach out to each other. They communicate. We have two that walk, and this boy goes and grabs the hand of the girl, and they go for a walk almost every afternoon, the two of them. They're teenagers. Most of our children, I'd say we have about 10 that are under 12. Most of them are from 12 to 23. So we have some that need shaving, and we have some that are beginning to be aware of their adulthood coming on, and they're easy to get attached to, I think, especially because they're so dependent on their caregivers. And there's a real bond that grows up there. And many of our volunteers that leave us watch on our website the news of their children for years. Thousands of people look at our website every month, I guess, and when a child dies, for example, we get letters from all kinds of volunteers and people that have known that particular child, and telephone calls. It's really something that is really beautiful.
They're kind of like mothers to these children. They take care of them. They raise them together with the volunteers. They run the place. And at one point, they even taught Hebrew to Arab children, because at that time, children had to learn Hebrew that came there because they went to a Hebrew-speaking school. So the sisters took the time to teach the Arab children Hebrew. Today, they try to teach the children in their own language, even in the schools. So the Arab children learn in Arabic and, the Jewish children in Hebrew, because it's very hard for a disabled child to have to deal with all these languages. They all learn a little bit of English, because Sister Susan speaks English, obviously. The sisters' language among themselves is French and English. And the volunteers all speak English with the children. But it's very loving and kind, and it's like a family. You enter and then you come into this beautiful place on the mountains of Ein Kerem, surrounded by these pine trees, this old Arab building, beautiful. And these sisters are taking care of the kids and the volunteers. They're kind of mothers to the volunteers there, because they are very young people who come to work there. And it's a very warm atmosphere. Usually you have 8 children to one person working in normal institutions. Because they have volunteers who come from Europe, they have 4 children to one volunteer. So these volunteers become like their parents, and they have the time actually to take every child out of their wheelchair, put them on, pillows and in different positions. these children are very isolated because they can't really move and many can't see very well, so they don't even see who's in front of them. And they're always in wheelchairs, so they take them out all the time. They take them for walks, and they have a beautiful garden outside with playgrounds for them to stimulate them. They have, like, discs hanging, you know, so that the children can touch them, feel the shape, and hear the sound of these old disc CDs I'm talking about, you know, in the wind, and all kind of shapes, the smells of different spices in the garden so that they are stimulated, you know, that their sense of smell is stimulated. And they have what I was so impressed by, a beautiful dog called Pam, who became the best friend of the children. They have something called dog therapy there. And it's not just dog therapy, it's animal therapy, but the dog is the most important animal because they take the children out to that garden and they put them on a mattress, they lie there, and the dog comes and gives them kisses and lies to them, and they touch the dog and they play with the dog and they lose their fear, and they actually have an animal responding to them normally. An animal cannot treat them strangely, so the animal just cuddles up with them. And you know, it's very special, and they come out very happy. They enjoy that very much. They love to go out. Another thing that they have that is wonderful is that music therapy. There's a young, beautiful Russian-Israeli woman who comes and gives them music lessons. And you see them like three children in one class, and they love to drum. And they play the drums, and then another one improvises on the piano. Now, these are the children that can use their hands. There are some that are not in a position to do that at all. But those who can, they do that. The others, they just listen to music, you know, they play to them many classical music to calm them down. And then the other thing is the jacuzzi. They have a jacuzzi there, and for that you need volunteers. And the volunteers that are working there are not enough, so people come in to help out because you can only take two people at a time maximum into the jacuzzi. But the jacuzzi helps them with their cramped-up bodies because these children are sitting in very cramped positions most of the time to relax, you know, to let the circulation run normally, and they love the water. Water and music and the animals, that's really what gives them pleasure. Two can walk, and they wobble around the premises, and they hold hands. It's very cute. And when they see Sister Susan, they come and they hug her. It's a very special place, and they have also room that has special stimulation there. They have a machine there that puts certain lights and dots to stimulate the eye because a lot of children have bad vision. Then they have all kinds of different fabrics to touch for them to stimulate their touching. And of course the touch. Every time Sister Susan walks in, she gives each child a hug, and they just respond to, you know, to the touch.
Not long ago, I asked Sister Susan if some of her children, especially those without a family of their own, ever wanted for love and affection.
Oh, we hope not, because of all our children that cannot sometimes move their arms and legs, they still have a beautiful smile. Maybe we have one child or two only that is so handicapped that they're unable to smile. Both have beautiful smiles, and it shows that they feel loved.
There is no doubt in my mind that today all of Sister Susan's children, Arab and Jew alike, are lighting up her world with smiles. In a place where once two women with child embraced.
You can have my heart, but it isn't new. It's been used and broken, and only comes in blue. It's been down a long road.
I'm Tracy McClure. Again, thank you for listening. Bye-bye. Laudator Jesus Christus.
If I give it to you, will you make it clean?